You are listening to Radio Albion.
Hello, everyone, and again, this is Matthew Raphael Johnson, and this is the Orthodox Nationalist. It is Sunday afternoon, I should say Sunday evening. It is the 6th of September, 2026, Labor Day weekend. And before I get into the topic, I really want to thank everyone again for their support. There have been really rough times. The first half of this year, the second half of last year were absolutely brutal. You guys came through. You came through in 2015 when I was in serious trouble. The first time I ever asked for money in my life. I hate it. But you did it anyway. Because you know who I am. And what I am. And whether it be a dollar, for a Bitcoin or 5 Bitcoin, I don't care. It is something of you, and it's a vote of confidence, and I can't really say anything more about it. Thank you very much. Now, today's subject is the Judaizers of what we would call medieval Russia. Medieval Russia would be the equivalent of early modern Western Europe. The paper that I'll publish somewhere, I guess, The Occult War on the Third Rome, The Case of the Judaizers in the Late 14th and Early 15th Centuries. The premise here is that Russia's transformation after the fall of the Second Rome, that is Constantinople, into the spiritual center of Christian civilization coincided precisely with the establishment of a secret Jewish occult center in the Western Russian lands, at the time occupied by Poland and Lithuania. The resurrection of Rome terrified the Jewish elite of whatever background. The Talmud says that Jews are at war with Rome. Although the Jews were temporarily barred from entering Russia, but a gradual covert advance against this stronghold of the Christian world continued, and they continued relentlessly. These movements took the form of some pre-Luria Kabbalistic pagan science. It was a foreshadowing of Freemasonry. I don't have to tell you that mainstream scholarship on this topic is so bad that you know less about the subject after reading it than when you began. Partially because they're terrified of, you know, the Jewish issue, and partially because they don't know a damn thing about Jewish theology, and partially because they know nothing about Russian Orthodoxy. But at this period of time, you had a particular fascination in Western Europe with the Kabbalah and the pagan sciences in general. We call it the Renaissance, the creation of Florentine bankers. Some of their books started appearing in large numbers in Russia, translations from European languages, books like Aristotle's Gates, The Secret of Secrets, The Sixth Winged One, by Emmanuel Ben Jacob Bonfils of Tarascon, and then Tereptniki, which is best translated as The Trembler. Now, these are often attributed to ancient Egyptian and Arabic sages. They were not. They were the more recent writings of the Jewish Kabbalists. The phenomenon of the traveling rabbis. They were disguised as physicians and healers. And there were one group that widely disseminated these works. They were not the only one. They recounted miracles about their healing skills and the extraordinary knowledge of these secret sciences. Before the rise of this Judaizing heresy in particular, there were rumblings about it. Oh, by the way, I should say that Soviet historiography, and this may not shock you, banned the use of the word Judaizers. No, you had to use Novgorod-Moscow heresy. Now, prior to this, you had something called the Strigolniki sect, and operated mostly in Pskov, which is very close to Kroki in Lithuania. It's one of the main centers of the Karaites. Although the connection to this group has been disputed. Lizarova, the word Strigolnik is based on a Hebrew phrase to make secret, to hide, but also to reveal, to expose. Translated properly, the word Strigolnik means one who preserves a revelation in order to later reveal it. The concept close to the vocabulary of the secret societies, the Gnostics and Manichaeans. St. Stephen of Perm, who died in 1396, talks about the connection of the Strigolniki to the Karaite Jews and what they had to say about various things. Metropolitan Phocius of Kiev, in 1427, he says that this group imitated the accursed Sadducees. This is why they thought there was no hope of any resurrection. Well, if that's true, then they were materialists of one kind or another. They believed in a vague concept of God. The Strigolniki, Karaites, and others, they certainly didn't believe in Christ. But this culminated in the Judaizing sect in Novgorod. And it was headed up initially by Skaria Sidovin, whose real name is probably Zechariah ben Aaron HaKohen, carrying out a task assigned to one of the international Jewish centers and drew on the experience of what had happened with the Strigolniki. In a short period of time, he assembled a secret society. Initially, that society had 33 members, of course, 27 of whom were priests in Novgorod, their immediate relatives, deacons, and clergy. Skaria, so known as the Prince of Taman, arrived in Novgorod from Kiev in the retinue of Prince Mikhail Lilkovich. He was well-educated. He was internationally connected. Again, it said he was a Karaite. There's been some dispute about that. That's unimportant to me. But he certainly had a wide network of organizations in Europe and in the Middle East. You'll know what a Karaite is. They're known for rejecting the Talmud. But in rejecting the Talmud, they allowed themselves to, vulnerable to things like the Kabbalah. The Karaite movement arose in the 8th century in Babylonia in response to the Talmudic ideology. They incorporated minor Jewish sects and some of the Sadducee traditions. They didn't have rabbis. The Karaites believed that they had a right to appeal to the so-called law of Moses in their definition, without any intermediaries. And there are two great men who fought this. In fact, two great men who saved Russia. Because you'll see here, for the next 50 minutes, an hour and 10 minutes, that these men almost succeeded in taking power in this country with a handful of men. The first is St. Gennadia, or Gennadius, the Archbishop of Novgorod, who responded to this movement by purifying the text of the Old Testament that he had available to him. He wanted to put it in a single codex, translating it into proper Russian. The other one was St. Joseph of Volok, or Volokomansk, who wrote a book called The Illuminator, written specifically against this movement. The third wasn't as significant, but was St. Neil Sorsky, who was no enemy of St. Joseph. We'll get to that here in a little bit. And this is the troika, so to speak, that defeated the Judaizing movement. The Judaizing heresy wasn't an ordinary heresy, and I don't even like using the term. It's more an ideology of state destruction. It's a conspiracy aimed at changing the very worldview of the Russian nation and the forms of their social existence. Calling it a heresy is, I don't think it's technically correct, even though St. Joseph did use that term, since there was never any claim to being Orthodox. Well, except in their public behavior, of course. They're very odd, and the oddities of this movement, compared to typical heresies, were evident from the very beginning. Its adherents were not at all concerned with converting among the people, which would have made sense for people who sincerely believe in their own righteousness. Far from it, the heretics carefully selected candidates for recruitment from among the high clergy, the administrative structure, that is, the elite. This is something that Martin Luther also did for a time. They pretended to be Orthodox in public, but it was this ostentatious piety that led to their rise in society. Their outward activities were aimed at infiltrating the apparatus of power, both secular and spiritual. Their political goal, simply put, was to seize power, and they almost succeeded. And it's odd, you know, to hear, whether it be people at the time or scholars today, talk about the fact that they rejected the Trinity, divinity of Jesus Christ, rejected the church sacraments. Well, yeah, of course. This is a Judaic movement. Of course they will. But you need to remember the context and who someone like St. Gennadius is addressing. But the main tenets of this movement undermine the very structures of church life, its mystical roots, dogmatic tradition, and organizational structure. Once that goes, the entire society falls apart, and that's what they were counting on. Sicaria recruited Dionysius, Dennis, who was a man very quick to succumb to his teachings. And then he brought on another priest, Alexei. Sicaria brought two more teachers then from Lithuania, Simonia Skarigavi and Moses Kapush, seeing how quickly that he was gaining adherence. These priests were so zealous that they wanted to get circumcised, but the Jews prevented them from doing it. They didn't want that to be used as evidence later on. Adhere to our teaching secretly, while openly remaining full Orthodox, strictly observing outward piety. These newly converted Judaizers made every effort to obtain priestly positions later on, higher up the hierarchy, in order to effectively influence as many people as possible. These infiltrators were distinguished by their learning, and I put that in quotes. Learning in the sense that it was novel and was liberating. They possessed books unavailable to the Orthodox clergy. The problem with that is, if the books were unavailable, then they weren't able to successfully combat them. You have to know your enemy better than they know themselves. You have to be able to argue their position better than they can. It's one of the things that going to a regular, you know, state university grad school for a doctorate did for me. I saw them from the inside. They don't know us from the inside. God knows. Now, these men didn't reveal their Judaism to their disciples, which is typical for the Arcana. Their first goal was to arouse basic doubts in certain passages in the Bible. But Scripture was just a prop for them. They were occult initiates. They were Jews, but they were occult initiates. What mattered was the pagan theology behind them. At the same time, these Jews tempted their imaginations with the unspeakable delights of Kabbalah, the acceptance of wealth, and the proverbial community of wives, that is to say, a sexual revolution for them. Despite their outward displays of piety, there were ritual when they were alone, when they were with the group behind closed doors, they did commit the most outrageous desecration of Orthodox sacred objects, icons and crosses, permitting themselves unheard of blasphemy against them. It had a psychological purpose. Now, once he had a small group in Novgorod, Zakaria considered it prudent to leave the country with the two men he had brought over. In other words, the men there that he had converted, they'll take it from here. Now, in the West, they were well acquainted with Judaizing heresies all over the place. Slowly, they were falling victim to them entirely. But that would take quite a while. These secret societies, they were just beginning. And had existed in the first centuries of Christianity. All their teachings were, to a greater or lesser extent, based on Kabbalistic and satanic mysticism. At a minimum, the goal of these sects were the destruction of religious, familial, and governmental agency, everything, the structure of Christian societies, and the mentality behind them, which is crucial. From there, power can be seized through money, debt, the manipulation of powerful figures. The Western world did fall from orthodoxy. When they did so, they faced an explosive spread of these heresies, these movements. The Albigenses, for example, just this one off the top of my head, they had transformed the south of France, according to one contemporary, into a new Judea. In fact, a full-fledged crusade was called in 1208 by Pope John III. A few centuries later, they had fallen entirely. Against this, the Metropolitan of Novgorod found a powerful ally, the famous abbot of the local Minsk monastery, St. Joseph. And this is the best ally you could ever want in a struggle like this. I want to talk about someone who's been mangled in Western scholarship. Not so much from contempt, but from complete ignorance. It's unreadable. Joseph was known, his devotion to the monastic rule went from Athos to Kiev and to the rest of Russia. He was elected abbot of the Borovsk Monastery, the far west of northern Russia, near Kaluga. Joseph wanted to strengthen obedience to the rule. And all these great reformers, you know, that's what they want to do first and foremost. And of course, the brethren don't like this. They were used to a less strict interpretation. Eventually, he simply left. Went to the Voloka Monk Forest, where he founded a monastery of his own. He was known for difficult feats of supreme asceticism, and his learning and erudition were nationally known. And he saw the Judaizers not only as contemptible, but also insolent. One of the worst things is that they had a metropolitan elected, Zosima. Joseph quite boldly rose up against him, wrote a letter to Bishop Nifont of Suzdal, calling him and the rest of the synod to rise in defense of Orthodoxy. That's how high it went. It almost converted Tsar Ivan III. Almost. We'll get to that here in a minute. But that triumph, it didn't last long. The local leader, Fyodor Kuritsin, who died roughly 1498, that was a huge loss for them. He had direct communication with Ivan III. For him, this had nothing to do with Judaism. This was just astrology. And there were many rulers in the West that were very interested in this kind of thing. To move way ahead of myself here, the final synod was the end of 1504. Point is that this movement moved very, very quickly. Once a small group was established in Novgorod, the wealthiest city of Russia at the time, it moved very quickly and solely infected the elites. Russians in general, though, they could not accept the misanthropic and arrogant tone of the Talmud or the nonsense of the Kabbalah. I mean, it's hardly comprehensible to any normal person, let alone, you know, a Russian peasant. Not to mention the Jews' desire to elevate themselves above other peoples. And beyond that, Russians were repelled by the commercial spirit. The Jews, they had emerged in Russia as early as the end of the first millennium. The Russian Chronicles, Nestor's Chronicle, there's a story of how St. Vladimir chose Orthodoxy, this earth-shaking decision. Yes, it happened. Just this is a highly simplified and condensed version of what happened. Later, St. Vladimir Monomakh, who became enraged by the rabbis' advances and their seduction of Christians to Judaism. I'm sorry, not Judaism, ethnically, but, you know, Jewish practices, gathered princes under him for a council, the famous Council of Vyborg. He established the following law. He said this: all Jews are to be expelled from all Russian lands, are not to be admitted again, and if they enter secretly, they will rob and kill. Letters were sent to all the cities about this, according to which they were immediately expelled everywhere. From this time on, there are no Jews in Russia. When one arrives, they do one thing: they rob and kill the people. Now, in the statute of Prince Yaroslav from the 11th century, sexual relations between Russian women and Jews, zhidki, as they were known, that was considered a criminal offense. That was Canon 19. Section 19. Cohabitation between Russian men and Jewish women, punishable not only by a fine, but excommunication. Section 51. Remember what excommunication meant at the time. You were an outcast. You couldn't function in society at all. You essentially had to leave the country. In the 12th and 13th centuries, very early, Russians were forbidden from communicating at all with non-believers, primarily Jews. And the same goes for communication with the excommunicated. You were gone. Your family couldn't talk to you anymore. Let me quote from St. Joseph's famous book, The Illuminator. This is his section 13. If the infidel heretics do not deceive any of the Orthodox, then one should not do them harm. But when we see that the infidels and heretics want to deceive the Orthodox, then it is fitting not only to hate them, to condemn them, but also to curse and inflict wounds upon them, sanctifying one's own hand on the way. This is what St. John Chrysostom himself commands, and he writes, since we're talking about blasphemy against the only begotten Son of God, I now want to ask you for one gift, that you punish all blasphemers who appear in this city. If you hear that someone at a crossroads or in the marketplace among the people blasphemes the Lord Christ, go up and rebuke him. If you have to beat him, don't turn away. Strike him on the cheek, crush his lips, and sanctify your hand with a wound. If they seize you, drag you to court, go. If the judge interrogating you demands testimony, say with boldness that he blasphemed the King of Angels. For he who blasphemes an earthly king must be given over to torture. How much more does this apply to those who blaspheme the heavenly king? Sin lies on everyone if there is no truth. It befits everyone who needs it. Let both Jews and pagans know that Christians are the saviors of the state, its builders, its protectors, and its teachers. Let the unbridled and depraved Jews and heretics know that they must fear God's servants. They ever decide to say anything inappropriate, let them keep an eye on each other everywhere. Let them tremble and be afraid of even the shadows as soon as they hear the word Christian. Now, when I read that, there's not a free English translation online, but I read it in Russian. It just, there's a certain poetry there because, you know, our people are afraid and tremble that the Jews are going to, you know, and the laws that they have promoted are going to send us to prison for something. So there was a quote within a quote there. Two saints, St. Joseph and St. John Chrysostom. So there's no question. This is the Orthodox teaching. St. Joseph calls the Judaizers apostates. Sometimes he calls them heretic. Usually it's just simply apostate. But again, I'm uncomfortable with that because these Jews were never Orthodox. They were never a part of the church. But it doesn't matter. St. Joseph states that their acts are worse, not only than actual heretics, but even worse than pagans. He says, apostates are not equal or identical in their malice. For there are some apostates who were born in Orthodoxy and after living for a few years, were deceived, either in childhood or through ignorance or out of fear and captivity, and fell away from it. But they themselves are subject to heresy and evil belief and have not deceived any of the Orthodox. And if they wish to repent and return to the Orthodox faith, then, of course, it's surprising, but they're nevertheless worthy of mercy, according to the divine canons of the Holy Fathers, above all, the great Methodius, the Confessor, Patriarch of Constantinople. But there are other apostates, worse than the first, born and raised in the Orthodox truth, not in infancy, not in captivity, not because they were subject to torture, but men who willfully reject Christ. St. Basil the Great writes of such people in the 73rd canon. He who has rejected Christ and become a criminal against the mystery of salvation must remain among those who mourn throughout their lives and must confess at the end of his life is deemed worthy of partaking of the holy gifts by faith and God's love for mankind. So again, a quote and another quote. Two tremendous authorities, St. Joseph and St. Basil the Great. That kind of apostate, the latter group, may only receive communion at the end of his life. St. Joseph also knew the conversion to Orthodoxy of the 40-year-old Jew Theodore, the Jidovin, or Theodore the Jew. And Theodore wrote a group of letters from 1448 to 1461. well known in church circles at the time. He, of course, converted to Orthodoxy, for real, not in the Judaizing way. And we know some of these people today. Not only was he trying to enlighten Russians and Russian Orthodox, but also speaking to Jews. These letters go into great detail. He says that even if his people had wanted to know the true light, he would have spoken with them in great detail, even verbally. The author expresses such joy, Theodore expresses such joy at the approach of his fellow tribesmen with questions about the truth of the faith, sharply reproaches them for miring themselves in the unbelief and the paganism of Judaism. Scudia's victims in Novgorod, the original Scudia, the first Jew who came over. His first victims, as I mentioned, Dionysius or Denis and Alexei. After that, his converts came from new preachers appearing there. The arrival of Jewish merchants, simply by virtue of their work, they interacted frequently with the local clergy because the clergy in Novgorod were in charge of trade, weights, and measures. So constant contact provided these newcomers with favorable opportunities to preach and instill their views among the clergy, the high clergy. Conversations between Jews and people inclined to doubt fell on fertile soil. Even in the homily in St. Varlaam of Kutin, the November Menaeon of 1438, we find reference to a mention of a different sort of a Jew. So how did they attract converts? Well, initially, it was through a simplified rationalism. Everything seemed to be clear. But like Freemasonry, that was only the introduction. Neophytes were attracted by the freedom so beloved by the proud intelligentsia even back then. That freedom, in its extreme form, where everything is permitted, went so far as to encourage fornication, drunkenness, sodomy, and that's a crucial element to all of this. By magic and astrology, which were very fashionable in the West at the time, gave them a certain superiority to everyone else who didn't know about it. But they were lured by the Judeo-occult teachings. It elevated the initiates to this esoteric level, unavailable to the uninitiated. They saw themselves as intellectual aristocracy. So Scudia wisely left the country after his initial very small group was formed. But he did direct the process, first from Lithuania and then from the Crimea. The Judaizer's success in Novgorod was impressive. He even had the archpriest of the St. Sophia Cathedral and many of the wealthy civilians. Remember, Novgorod was an oligarchy. And because it was an oligarchy, you don't really have ruling principles. Many times they were willing to throw their Russian citizenship, their Russian language, their Russian orthodoxy out the window if the Poles provided them a more secure claim on their property. That's what oligarchs do. That's what oligarchs do everywhere. There were always a thorn in the side. And it wasn't until really Ivan IV, Ivan the Terrible, that group of oligarchs were finally exiled to various parts of Russia. This is not a democratic part of Russia. This is not a republican part of it. It is a plutocracy. The elite there own slaves. It's a very different sort of society. Apologetic works on things like relics and icons have been found in the city. At the beginning of the 15th century, that proves that there were already representatives of that movement in Novgorod, troubling minds of the city's elite, so to speak. What was it about the Judaizing heresy that appealed to Novgorodians? Well, I think I kind of answered part of that already. It confirmed the oligarchy in their position. But something else, there's some aspects of the of their rewriting of the Old Testament systems teachings closely aligned with Russian pagan beliefs. This is not the Old Testament. This is how they wrote it. This is why St. Gennadius had to make sure that he had the proper translation and put out the first full Russian Bible. Yeah, of course, the Bible existed, but not in one place. Ever since the removal to Babylonia, Jews were had become pagan. Did believe in other gods. The Old Testament God in their mind was material. But most of all, it justified the powers that be. It justified usury and plutocracy. See, Kabbalah explicitly rejects any concept of evil. So the will alone rules. Whatever the concept of God they have is reducible to the unsof. The unsof, the flux upon which the rabbis can imprint their sense of meaning. Now, if you go to my lecture on Adam Kadmon, I could clarify. That should clarify some of this. I go into the Kabbalah in great detail. I mean, you can't do it in an hour. Obviously, it's a highly simplified summary of what the Kabbalah is. I did it, I think, last year, the end of last year. The Arcana spread throughout Novgorod and beyond. St. Joseph wrote, even if someone didn't join their sect, many learned from them to rebuke the divine scriptures. And in the markets, in their homes, they began to argue and doubt the faith. And such confusion arose among Christians as has never arisen since the Son of Piety began to rise in the Russian land. In other words, even if you only have a passing acquaintance with them, it still may plant a seed such that you begin rejecting orthodoxy. But what this does, as problematic as it is, it forces the best of orthodoxy to rebuke them and to clarify the intellectual truth that needs to be brought out, especially that of what the Jews are in relation to orthodoxy. And they did just that. Ivan III sent an army, campaigned against the city, it was 1478. And he did it because, of course, Novgorod was always a problem, always had traitors within it, were far more concerned with money than the common good. But Ivan noticed something else. Novgorodians were appearing in Moscow for trial. The mayor of Novgorod, Zakhary Ovanov, for example. Again, this is Joseph writing about this. Came from Great Novgorod to the Grand Duke, the Tsar, with many Novgorodians, answers them for some of the things that he had wronged, to sue others. But the boyars came too. The oligarchs, Vasily Mikiforov, Ivan Kuzmin, many others. This hadn't happened before. And in fact, it became a flood. You see, Moscow always held itself out as the Supreme Court. If you didn't like what the Novgorod court had to say, that meant you had a lot of boyars who were quite willing to support Russia, or Moscow, I should say. And these men sometimes would enter into the service of the Tsar. of good audience who came to Moscow in search of justice had encroached on one of the central concepts of their own system. And it showed the growing weakness of the Novgorod city. Not just secular Novgorodians either, but monks, the married clergy. They would bypass their immediate superiors. If they didn't like what was said, they knew they could always go to Moscow. And that certainly served Moscow's interests. 1578, as you well know, Novgorod was finally annexed to the Russian state. But throughout this process, the Judaizers began to migrate to Moscow. Alexei and Denis had an audience with Ivan III, and Ivan was captivated by their erudition, alleged, and eloquence. He brought to Moscow and installed as rectors the two main cathedrals. They became rectors of the two main cathedrals, Dormition and the Archangel. It was a campaign against the elites. A weak link could always be found. Members of Ivan's own family fell into the Judaizing heresy. Elena Voloshenko, the wife of the heir, Vasil III, enjoyed performing magic. It penetrated the government right in Moscow, the boyars as well as the merchant classes. The chief heretic supervisor, recruited by Skadia himself in Crimea, was the clerk Fyodor Kuritsin, who was the Minister of Foreign Affairs, who essentially was the Tsar's right-hand man. Let's mention the fact that in the second half of the 15th century, quite a number of Italians and other foreign specialists, like architects and engineers, arrived in the capital with ideas from the Renaissance, the debauchery, the free morals, and in fact, straight-out Satanism. There were differences between the Novgorod and Moscow circles of this heresy, this movement. It had more to do with their social affiliation than anything else. Now, all of these heretical movements, Strigoniki, the Gensis, Paulicians, they all seem to have that a few things in common. And it's very vague because they are, they have an esoteric element which in their mind should not be written down. But it's amazing how much they in fact have in common. But the overwhelming majority of Judaizers in Novgorod, they were clerical. They belonged to the clergy. But in Moscow, they were laymen. But powerful laymen. The Tsar's daughter-in-law was a big deal. The representative of the boyar children, Mitya Klinov, and the merchants of Klinov and Zubov, as well as a random Hungarian named Martienko, which doesn't sound Hungarian to me. Clearly, the Judaizers initially were people of very different religious backgrounds, but they had one thing in common when they came to this, that they all had very close relationships with Grand Duke or Tsar Ivan III. According to St. Joseph, in the capital, as in Novgorod, Judaizers held meetings at which Jewish-style rituals were performed. Those meetings were quite closed, and there are no instances of outright blasphemy against Christian sacred objects are known from the Moscow period. I'm sure it happened. In the capital, the heretics focused not on the promotion of anti-Christian or Judaic ideas, but in criticizing Holy Scripture intellectually and disseminating astrology. And they did this because Ivan III developed an interest in it. Metropolitan of Moscow, Gerontius, died in 1489. And this is when a member of the Judaizing sect, Zosima, Bradati in 1490, took the throne of Metropolitan of Moscow. Archbishop Gennady was furious. And the only thing he could do is to figure out a way to expose him. Saint Gennady, in a letter to the now Metropolitan Zosima, insisted on convening a synod against heretics, at which he proposed exposing them, including the now deceased Archpriest Alexei, as well as Ivan Cherny and Ivan Zubov, who, by the way, fled the country where, according to Archbishop Gennady's testimony, had fully embraced the Kabbalah. They embraced the Kabbalah, at least in part, because they thought it was the same thing as Old Israel. But Gennady also condemned Tsar Ivan III. He was a very brave man, because during the ongoing restructuring of the Moscow Kremlin, he ordered the removal of the old-style churches and some of the old monasteries from the Kremlin, which included the desecration of former altars and the transfer of burial sites. It wasn't deliberate disrespect, but Gennady said that these actions are done through the approval and money of the Jews of Kiev. In his writings at the time, Gennady contrasted the impiety of the Russian ruler with, for example, the Spanish king. So the Inquisition cleansed his land of heresy in a rational and legal way, even more so than the state itself. You know, when I was a Roman Catholic, SSPX, that kind of thing, I read quite a bit on the Spanish Inquisition, and it was nothing like you think. Well, nothing's like you think. It was a very proper, a very rational way to go about this. At the same time, Gennady addressed a letter to the Synod of Bishops, who met in Moscow in October of that year, 1490. There, he just focused on one thing, iconoclasm. And he did this because iconoclasm isn't just the smashing of icons. An icon isn't just an icon. It is the entirety of Christian culture. It's ultimately Protestantism. Iconoclasm means a lot more than just we can't show Christ in an image. It's every aspect that derives from that, any aspect of Christian culture. Ivan III, at this point, was, through Karitsyn, fell under the influence of the Judaizers. Again, this was their apogee. This was their zenith, so to speak. Now, he was never a member. He never was a part of it. He didn't really necessarily cover up for them, but he did turn a blind eye to them. Ivan's character and worldview were favorable to them. He was a Westernizer by conviction. Sovereign was he was very cautious, diplomatic with his opponents, indecisive. For example, during the famous standoff at the Ugra River in 1480, there was a moment where Ivan III was ready to make concessions to the Tartars, if not for the threatening letters of the Metropolitan of Moscow, who urged him to stand firm, that might have ended very differently. In traditional historiography, that standoff at the Ugra River marks the end of Mongol rule over Russia. The organization of this Judaizing sect, it would remind you of future Freemasonry in many ways. Strict secrecy, infiltration, the highest levels of government and clergy, a certain ritual. There was even a rite of desecration of holy relics, formation of this teacher-student system, and so much else. Judaizers were uncontrollable enemies of Christianity. But they were able to conceal their hatred for it, planning on gradually destroying it from within. Those who were steadfast in faith, the heretics presented themselves as wonderful Christians, and even zealots for Orthodoxy. We need to keep this in mind. I had the feeling, if you're listening to this, this should remind you of a lot of our own situation. You can't merely say, go by external actions of somebody. It's one of the benefits of being around for a long time. I've been doing this for, you know, professionally at least, for 30 years. Not much you could say about me. Judaizers were masters of deception. Moses Maimonides actually was a big part of this. His logic was a seminal text in this movement. Al-Ghazi, Anan bin David, one of the major authors in Kabbalah at the time. St. Joseph said, Zechariah was learned in every invention of evil, sorcery, and black magic, astrological law, and astrology. As early as the 10th century, the Karaites had close ties with Jerusalem and Constantinople. 10th century Jerusalem was connected with Trochai, which is in Lithuania, of the Middle Ages, through the fruitful intermediary of the Karaite center in Constantinople. 12th and 13th centuries, German rabbis in Regensburg invited Karaite writings through Russia, received Karaite writings through Russia. Now, at that date, of course, the rabbis were at war with the Karaites. That's true. But if they said something that could be used against the Slavs and Christianity, they'll use it. The communities in Crimea and Kiev, always getting literature from this area, from Babylonia, Palestine, and Constantinople. The rapid spread of this Jewish nonsense in Russian clergy, you know, it cries out for an explanation. But it is based, at least in part, on the state of Orthodox doctrine and church literature at the time. The Psalms were found in the heretic's possession. Turned out to be the Jewish prayer book, the Mahazor. Literally means cycles. A commandrite, Varlam, of the Kirillo Bilozersky Monastery, he remarked when he read this particular version of the Psalms, he said, not a single psalm in this translation contains any prophecies about Christ. The Hebrew translations were being used. Nikolai Tikhonov concluded that this is not the normal Psalter of David, but Jewish prayers used in worship services. Someone had been gradually switching them out, and over time it became accepted as real, as true. In the 15th century, the Pentateuch was corrected according to the Hebrew text. The book of Daniel was translated within the Kabbalist, but certainly not the Greek tradition. Ivan Yevseyev noted that these translations testify to the high and exceptional respect for the translator for Judaism. In the Christological prophetic passages, rabbinic understanding is expressively introduced. They're not using the Greek, they went to the Hebrew. They went to an already distorted source. I mentioned already the six-winged book with the Jewish calendar, astrological treatises, and the very early atheistic works of Raymond Lully were translated into Russian, 15th, 16th centuries. These are the kind of things that helped Zechariah convert these clergymen. Over time, some of their literature actually had been written by their enemies. By the way, Dacian Patrikiv. Some of you may, I haven't mentioned him yet. Dacian Patrikiv. He died, I guess, in 1535. There's some issue about that. His nickname was Kosoy. It's the same person. He was one of the central figures. He had been a monk at one point, although by force. We'll get to him more later on. But the use of texts alien to the Orthodox tradition in Russian service books, that by itself raised doubts about the correctness of their confession. The first outward manifestation of this tendency, as early as the 1470s, were iconoclastic, citing their version of the Pentateuch. By 1480, as I said, the heretics had penetrated Moscow. Now, this didn't last for long. The victory that they had, eventually Ivan realized the truth, that their agenda was extremely anti-royal. On the Tsar's orders, several heretics, identified by Gennadius, were arrested and subject to what was called a city execution. It's not an execution. It's punishment with a whip at the marketplace for the desecration of icons. But the patrons of the Judaizers, high-ranking ones, prevented the condemnation of the heresy as such. So at the Synod of 1488, only minor criminals were declared guilty. And the sect itself wasn't named at all. In 1490, the accursed Metropolitan Zosima, who was a secret and sometimes not so secret supporter of the Judaizers, became head of the Russian Church. St. Joseph called him a second Judas. Being metropolitan doesn't mean you control everything. The Synod of the Russian Church publicly condemned the heretics, calling their deeds simple matter of Judaism. They were Judaic. The Orthodox Church had its finest representatives here, Gennadius, Joseph, and Nilus of the Suara River. They were the church's rebuke to these people. They went through the church books, and anything alien to the tradition was removed. Jewish synagogue texts and all questionable passages had been eliminated. A new edition of the full Bible was completely translated, and that disarmed the heretics. The only thing they had left was simple open deception. In 2016, I wrote an article, roughly 2016, I can't remember exactly, wrote an article called The Mythical Confrontation Between Josephites and Non-Possessors as Ideological Wishful Thinking. I have to make this very clear. There was never any battle between these two men or the types of monasticism they represented. They were not enemies, not personally, not institutionally. That is an enormous myth. St. Joseph's Illuminator, his most famed book, was partially written by St. Neil Sorsky. And in fact, the historian Nikolai Lisov convincingly has claimed that he wrote a huge part of it. In terms of personal property, the rules and basic customs of all Orthodox monasteries are identical on the issue of personal property. All monastic rules reject the owning of personal property, capital, by the individual monk, and even all higher officers too. The monastery as an institution, however, can possess property, since the monastery couldn't exist without it. This property is owned not by monks as people, but a corporate body. Neil Sikorsky himself, did he own his land? Did he have a title to it? Could he be kicked out at any time? English language literature, at least as of a few years ago, it's even asserted that St. Neil supported heresy, sought a separation of church and state. the regime's historians have tried to spin the distinction between the two forms of monasticism into a more familiar difference between liberalism and conservatism in medieval Russia. It couldn't be any less appropriate. One example of this could be found in a Russian history text. I mean, I chose it. This is from my paper. I did choose it kind of randomly, whatever was closest. And it was Russia, Tsarist, and Communists by A.G. Mazur from 1962. It's a very influential book. He calls this alleged rivalry between St. Joseph and St. Nil a sharp conflict. He says St. Nilus, or St. Nil, is an early champion of the separation of church and state. And then he makes something up entirely. He says, St. Joseph of Villok used Calvinist logic to argue that wealth was itself a grace of God for which each member should be grateful and praise the Almighty. He then goes on to say that St. Joseph insisted on a strict execution of church services, and that St. Nilus, or St. Nil, rejected the great adorned houses of worship, insisting the heart was more important than the temple. Even those who created the myth at the time never said anything like this. The Calvinist logic, that he made that up out of whole cloth. Jeffrey Hosking's Russia and the Russians from 2001, yeah, he kind of admits that the distinction might not be as important as once thought, but other issues still created a rivalry. The real fight, according to him, is over the connection between church and state. With St. Joseph advocating a quasi-papal view of church-state relations, while St. Nil said the church should avoid too close of an association with the state. This, too, is entirely invented. Here you have a part of American history where you have simply invented points of view. St. Nilus of Sorsky, St. Nilus of Swara, the Swara River, never, ever said anything like this. St. Joseph never said anything like this before. Evgeny Romanenko says the following in 1986. Nilus of Swara and Joseph of Volokomansk chose different forms of monastic life. Elder Nihilus the Skete, or the abbot of Volokomansk, chose a Kenobian. In accordance with this, they've chosen different systems of property ownership. There was no contradiction between them, as both systems date back to the early history of Orthodox monasticism. St. Joseph had nothing but praise for St. Nil. His own monastic house had plenty of anchorites or hermits on the grounds, like all monasteries had. The successor of St. Nil was St. Cornelii of Comel. The rule of St. Cornelius used elements of both rules in his own house. The Skete as well as the Kenobian, proving there was never any fight between the two. There's no distinction between the two forms of monastic life on capital punishment either. Monks of all types differed on it, especially in Russia. Russia didn't have the death penalty for much of its history. Elder Hermann, one of St. Nil's spiritual fathers, held that heretics under certain circumstances should be executed. Nikolai Lisov, a historian, writes, in other words, Vasian Patriki and the so-called non-possessor ideology is nothing more than the spiritual and intellectual provocation of a beleaguered elite. And that's certainly true. Lisov also states the following about the personal relationship between the two saints. They had the finest relationship. St. Joseph, local monks sent to St. Nil, Skete, his own monks. And the hand of St. Nil, and this is a staggering truth, can be found in the oldest edition of the Illuminator, St. Joseph. Some researchers are even ready to attribute the Illuminator to St. Nil himself, rather than Joseph, at least the shorter original version. But one thing is clear. Contrary to popular notions, both monks were very close to each other in doctrine and monastic life. St. Nil took Joseph's Illuminator as his own book, copied and distributed it to others. As far as monastic landholding is concerned, which is what the non-possessor controversy was all about, allegedly, monastic peasants were under the spiritual care of the respective monastery that cared about their spiritual and physical sustenance, and saw to it that drinking, gambling, and the like, which ruins the peasant economy, was eradicated. Unlike the noble estates, there was no arbitrariness under the monastics. No violence against women, which occasionally occurred in the estates of the nobility until the abolition of serfdom in 1861. Peasants weren't sold, they're not lost at cards, etc., etc., etc. Monks and serfs were equal. All monastics were commanded to perform manual labor. There was no distinction between the two, St. Joseph and St. Neil, in any respect but the monastic rule itself. There's been no Christian society in history that doesn't have both the larger property monastic house as well as a skeep. From England to Siberia, this has been the norm. Vasilian Patrikiv was an oligarch who claimed to speak for St. Neil and created what today we know as the non-possessor movement, which is something that St. Neil Sorsky would not have recognized. The landholding issue, which was completely invented, you know, he wanted it. He was from a noble family. It simply was a means to attack the institution as a whole, to eliminate the Orthodox Church as a social force. And it's been spun by these awful historians to refer to a battle between the Cenobium and the Skeet, rather than a polemical attack from a non-Orthodox disgraced nobleman like Vasian. St. Neil Sorsky never thought that the Cenobia in Russia should sell off their lands. Absolutely not. It is true that Ivan III was interested in a limited secularization of some monastic property. But as far as the two great abbots go, there's no distinction. Vasian Patrikiv, who was a heretic in the most extreme way, not an Orthodox man, in the Synod of 1503, Vasian spoke as if he had been given the authority of St. Neil and the Transvolga elders. That synod didn't have anything to do with landholding anyway, but things like widow clergy and technical issues over simony. The legend of the non-possessors came from Patrikiv and the old boyar class. The term non-possessor was used for the first time at Vasian's trial in 1531. In sections 4 and 5 of the Shorter Illuminator, a strict policy of non-possession is laid out for all of St. Joseph's monks, proving that none of these writers ever read the books, certainly not St. Joseph's. Contrary to the traditional account, St. Neil was one of the most popular authors to copy and disseminate among the monks at St. Joseph's Monastery. Vasian Patrikiv was descended from a noble Lithuanian family, directly from the Gediminids. His father, Ivan Jurevich, was a cousin of Grand Duke Ivan III. In the 1490s, Prince Vasily Patrikiv was a very influential figure in the highest Moscow circles. He took part in the war with Lithuania. He was voivod during the Russian-Swedish War, 1495-97. He participated in the highest state court. The dynastic struggle at the end of the 15th century, the family supported Dmitry Ivanovich. For this, in 1499, both fell into disgrace and were tonsured as monks. Vasily Patrikiv, under the name Vasian, ended up in the Cyril-Berezovsky Monastery. There he met Neil Sorsky, who became a mentor of sorts to the new monk. But despite the influence of St. Neil, Vasian could not stand the ascetic life. Despite his sentence around 1509, Vasian returned to Moscow, where he began to enjoy the favor of the new Grand Duke Basil III. In 1512, the first open clash between St. Joseph and Vasian took place. The local monk's abbot called on the Grand Duke to conduct a search of the new heretics of the Skeet. That's when Vasian wrote his work condemning St. Joseph and monasticism. Basil III sided with Vasian. It's unfortunate. Patrikiv retained his influence on the Grand Duke until this alleged fight, which he started, began. Patrikiv created this and pushed it so it would be a means of solving church, social, and even political problems. as I said many years ago. There was no non-possessorist movement. There was no battle between St. Joseph and St. Nosorsky. The so-called non-possessors weren't monks at all, but clerks and nobles. This was an oligarchic point of view. If you're going to sell off lands, perfect, they're the ones who are going to buy it or take it. It was a means also of weakening the monarchy. The monastic houses, both East and West, have been the most consistent supporters of centralization and nationalization of culture in the context of the church. In his response to the elders of Cyril Belozersky, represented a court faction, not the views of St. Neil. He did not write that. 19th century, liberal Westerners or Westernizers created the liberal St. Neil for their own purposes. St. Joseph advocated the traditional point of view that all church property is the acquired property of God, pledged, entrusted, and given to him, and St. Neil fully agreed. This may have to be a two-parter. All right. Everyone, I really appreciate you listening here. We're going to stop right here. This will be a two-parter. I have so many things coming up. My brain is absolutely skewered with everything. And if you wouldn't mind, buy my book on the Ukraine war. That wouldn't be all that bad. Thank you, my friends. I will see you next week. Bye-bye.